In the words of David Bowie, take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Welcome to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio on our intergalactic voyage through time and space. It's our annual trek into the final frontier to galaxies far, far away. Joining us today is a familiar voice to the show, John Jackson Miller. John lives in central Wisconsin. He's a New York Times best-selling novelist, graphic novelist, comic book writer, collector, and historian. John just received another Scribe Award for Best Original Novel Speculative by the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers for his latest novel, Star Trek Picard, Rogue Elements. John Jackson Miller, welcome back to Route 51.
Very glad to be here, Rick. How you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for coming in. We've also invited a couple of multi-award-winning actors who have recorded a combined 1,000-plus audiobooks, including many written by John Jackson Miller. While we'll get to know them over the next hour, let me introduce them to you right now. Robert Petkoff is a stage actor and singer, known for his work in Shakespearean productions and more recently on the New York City musical theater stage, and has appeared in film and television. He also provided the voices for over 350 audiobooks. Robert Petkoff, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you for having me. I should probably sing that with a Broadway sort of...
That would work in the show. Actor, voice artist, and director January Lavoie has starred on Broadway, been seen on television, and given voice to commercial campaigns, documentaries, and hundreds of audiobooks. In 2013, she was named Audiobook Narrator of the Year by Publishers Weekly. January Lavoie, welcome.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's great to be with you guys.
Oh, this is terrific. You know, I understand this is the first time, John, you've met January and Robert in the same.
That's absolutely right. And I've lived with their voices for quite some time. So it's, I'm absolutely delighted that we were able to do this. You know, Rick, you and I have done a show here every Christmas season for Wisconsin Public Radio for several years. And we were looking to do something that was different than me droning on about whatever happened to publish this year or last year. One of the best things about getting to do what we do, playing in these other sandboxes, Star Wars, Star Trek, other things, has been getting to do the audiobooks and be a part of that process and getting to hear them, because you spend all year writing a book. It's good to have somebody read it to you.
And John, you're talking about Star Wars and Star Trek. You've been writing these novels for several decades. What's changed since you started, and what really stays the same?
I did comics before I did novels, so it's been a different medium that I've been working in. And as I progressed, the things that have been available to us, again, when I started, we were just doing a small mass market paperback novels of the Star Wars books. They weren't doing audio yet. Star Wars and audio goes all the way back to the radio show that they did, the radio adaptations,
right,
that Brian Daley wrote the scripts for. He's the author that did the Han Solo novels, back in the day. But for a good while, there just weren't audiobooks of things. And so when I wrote the Star Wars Kenobi novel, that was my first brush with an audiobook. That was a book written by Jonathan Davis. And then when I switched over and started doing Star Trek as well, Star Trek likewise had done some audiobooks in the past, but one of the problems had been that the audiobooks were so long that they couldn't actually, do them unabridged. Things were on cassette tape as opposed to, CD. But, once Audible comes along, my second Star Trek fiction project is the Star Trek Prey trilogy. And, Robert narrates this, and it ends up being something like, 54 hours of content that, took me a year to create. But, in the course of in doing this project, Robert has 150 different voices, I think was my count, somewhere in that neighborhood, including five Klingon women, where he's doing, where he's performing these things. And then we actually have to start thinking about Klingon as well, the language and other things. And so as this has all evolved, the ways that people are getting these things, people are just as likely to know my work from you know, the audible version, the audio version of something as having read it in the book. You know, that's wonderful. It's also changed the way that I write the books. And we can get into that here in a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. And Robert, when creating these voices for the audiobooks, how do you go about developing distinctive character voices without going over the top, which could potentially lose a listener?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously the very first thing you do with any audiobook is you read the book. And as I go through the book, I'm obsessed with my iAnnotate app and my highlighters. And so every character gets a color. And that way, as I'm reading it, I can flip between characters quickly. You know, I know in advance, okay, this is going to be that person, this is going to be that person. And as I do it, I start to instantly, like anyone who reads a book, you start to create a voice in your head for a character. You know, I think everyone does that. They just keep their voices in their head, and I start saying them out loud. So as I'm reading the book, as I'm prepping the book, I will start to read the dialogue out loud. And start to go, oh yeah, no, that's wrong. And or you'll come across the thing where you'll start a character and five pages in, then the author will mention something about the timbre of their voice or their dialect. I once, to my great shame, did an entire book where I'd run out of time. I was doing a series of books and I got behind and I thought, well, I'll cold read this one. And that son of a gun author had written the character that showed up in the beginning of the book and 26 chapters later had him still talking and then he said in his light German accent, which I had never given. So we had to go back and pick up every single line. And fortunately, he didn't talk that much. But I was like, why would you not tell us that in the beginning? You know, not just for the audiobook narrator, but for the listeners. So I learned my lesson, and I go through that way, and I have to make sure that I want to make it unique, but I don't want to overact it. Underacting it is just as bad, because then I sometimes hear things and I think, I can't tell, is that the narrator or is that the character talking? So I always want to make sure that I'm very clear that way, but you're absolutely right. Though there are characters that you just get to go for. And when you do, especially Klingons, when you do, it's just a joy. Because, you know, all that Shakespeare training, all that stuff, you just want to, you know, when you get good language, when you know, the Klingon is so guttural, you know, that you just get to go for it. And it's a blast. By the way, that is my one-person show coming up is Five Klingon Women. I'll be bringing that to Broadway. Hopefully in the spring of 2023. Yeah.
Oh, so get your excited. Tickets now, right?
Now it has to be an opera in order to actually qualify for the Klingons.
Well, you know, here's an example of that Klingonese, would you call it? I don't know.
Revenge is a dish which is best served cold. Klingon proverb.
Classic quote. In January, I have the same question for you in creating the voices. How do you stop from, again, going over the top? And the other question that follows would be, are you a narrator or a performer?
Yeah, very similar to Robert's kind of way of working. And incidentally, Robert and I met doing theater many years ago. And, you know, so come from similar performance backgrounds, classical training, all that stuff. And so I think part of the answer for me is I find minor characters to really let it out of the box with so that I don't feel so constrained. As narrators, I think most of us, those of us who do character voices, and I just want to acknowledge that some narrators don't do broad character voices, and that's a totally legitimate way of approaching the work as well. But those of us who do, you know, I think that we have a sort of a stable of voices that we know we can access on short notice, be they, you know, a certain nasal quality or a certain accent or dialect or, you know, a certain gravelly quality. And the confidence that you have when you've used a voice before, maybe for something else or in a completely different context, but you know you can just sort of unleash it in a moment, it's just so much fun to play with. As I said, similarly to Robert, when I'm reading, I'm hearing, but I'm also visualizing. And I find when I do audiobook coaching, which I do with some folks, I've been talking a lot recently about the movie in your mind. And what I'm really trying to bring forward for the listener is what I'm visualizing. So it's not just the words on the page. It's investing in the images that the words conjure, and then trying to use the picture, the image, the whole totality of it, to inform the voices and the way you sort of score the emotion, whether it's more intimate or, you know, bigger and broader. So all of those things come into it. So narration is a type of performance. It's a very specific type of performance that we do. Not all actors love to narrate. Some phenomenal actors that I know well are like, I don't know how you do that. I did one audiobook and I just wanted to beat myself over the head with the iPad. So it's not for everybody, but for me, as somebody with a background in theater, I love it. And it feels like a very full mode of performance to me.
But I love how you stated that. That's sort of that movie in your head, because it's exactly what I do without ever having expressed it in that way. But that's exactly it. Just like whenever anyone reads, you start picturing what's going on. But for a narrator, especially, to say, okay, now do the movie in your head. For me, it becomes a bit of Bottom from Midsummer Night's Dream. Let me play the lion too.
Yes.
You know, you get to play all the characters, so it's fun.
Yep.
And in a sense, what I'm doing, writing the tie-in fiction, is just very quickly. I'm myself mimicking characters that I've seen from screen. I'm trying to make things sound like the characters in Star Trek, Star Wars, whatever I happen to be writing. And so I'm having to listen for their own intonations and everything, pretty much the same way you guys do, when you're telling the story, so it has that feel.
John Jackson Miller, January Lavoie, and Robert Petkoff are here with us today on our journey through time and space on Route 51. Ahead, we'll talk about turning pages into audio. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Look, it's a simple question. What was your job?
Emperor.
Emperor?
For a time, people used empress, but that's not to my tastes.
The prison official made a note on his slate. Emperor. Of what? This place?
Giorgio looked up and around. This space station doesn't exist in my universe, but it is in territory I conquered. Back in 53, I believe.
Freitas blinked. Beg pardon. You said, in your universe?
That's correct.
You own a universe?
A significant part of one.
She frowned.
Or I did.
You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer. Science fiction is our topic, more specifically, the lasting appeal of Star Wars and Star Trek. Now turning from our eyes to our ears, that was an audio excerpt courtesy of Simon & Schuster from Star Trek Discovery, Die Standing by John Jackson Miller, read by January Lavoie. January, what has surprised you the most about this kind of work?
This specific kind of work, which is different than doing other types of audio, I would say broadly, I describe it as, you know, I do fiction audiobooks, I do nonfiction audiobooks, and then I do properties. And I do both, you know, Star Trek and Star Wars properties, and there's a different kind of pressure. Normally, I'm thinking about, you know, serving the book, serving the characters, but when you're working on a property, I cannot help but think about serving the fans. I don't know if you, John, feel this similarly. But the level of passion and devotion and insight and the way that the fans are so deeply involved in the lives of these characters, I never want anyone to come away from one of those listens feeling disappointed or feeling that I made it unfamiliar to them, because it's the familiarity, you know, that they're coming back to the property for. And so that's been a real challenge in terms of trying to honor what's possible, because, you know, the sort of handshake deal that you make when it's a solo narrator, which of course is different than like when we do the Star Wars audio dramas, when we have, you know, a full cast. But when you have a solo narrator working on an audiobook, the handshake deal you make is that it's not me tapping out of the, you know, the booth and bringing someone else in to do the next character and the next character and the next character. When I say at the beginning of the book, narrated by January Lavoie, you understand it's just me in there. And so there's sort of a compact, and there's a level of trust that I'm asking for, that that what I'm doing to represent these characters is the best version I have of those particular characters. So there's a level of rigor that comes in, which I would say in like a different type of fiction book has more to do with my own imagination and creation. But in these properties, it's really about honoring a certain experience that people are looking to have. So it's that's a unique challenge in working on these types of books.
Do you see yourself trying to balance the differences and the properties of Star Wars and Star Trek? How do you do that in your mind when you're working on these projects?
I have to say, and again, I'm not someone who reads reviews because, you know, we all know, don't read the comments. When I first started doing both of these properties, it was really, really lovely to hear from the fans and to hear that they felt that I was doing a good job, doing what they wanted to hear, that they appreciated, that they felt I was bringing the books to life in a way that felt connected to the material, to them. So once that started to happen, I really had a different kind of confidence coming in. But there's also a ton of research that you have to do for these types of, John's nodding, if people can't see you, it's, you know, put it on the screen here, but there's so much research involved. You know, you really have to know, and it really takes a village to make one of these books, because, you know, our directors and our producers are providing clips, you know, which oftentimes you can't get those clips. Oftentimes they're not on the internet for good reason. And so, you know, there's all this sourcing that goes on, and what is the history of these? And then sometimes you're creating a new character or a new race of character. Okay, so what do they look like? You know, do they have gills? Do they have large nostrils? That's going to affect the way the character sounds. So all of these types of details in terms of the act of creation, it all comes into play. It's really a lot of fun, but it's very complex.
Robert, take us not just into the studio, but before you get into the studio, walk us through the process of recording a book of John's or another book that you've recently finished.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously in the Star Trek universe, the very first thing that happens for me is I go back to being 12 years old and watching the original series in syndication, and I loved that series. And that was my first sort of science fiction love. I moved on to, you know, Space 1999, and then Star Wars, of course, and as a 14-year-old, getting to watch that in the movie theaters for the first time when it first came out was a tremendous impact on me. I met George Lucas once backstage at a Broadway show, and just had to say, I know you've probably heard this 1,000,000,000 times, but you know, as a 14-year-old seeing Star Wars, that meant so much to me. I it was incredible. And of course, he was just like, oh, okay. You know, just he's a very, very calm, subdued man. But it for me, it starts there with my familiarity with Star Trek, and you know, the next generation, I have to sometimes watch episodes when certain characters come up. I feel like I don't know that character well enough. I'm doing it now with Strange New Worlds. I watched the entire series of Strange New Worlds. I started about a month ago and then binged it all. And I love the series. I love Anson. I love all the characters. But I love what Anson Mount is doing with Captain Pike. And so it's then when this latest book, which is The High Country, which is a Strange New Worlds novel that I just started working on this past week, I go back and listen again because I want to make sure that, again, I'm not going to imitate the characters. No one's going to go, oh my gosh, did Anson Mount record that? But I do want to honor the rhythm, maybe the timbre of a voice. Certainly if there's a dialect, La'an, the character, you know, is English, a British accent, and I want to do those things. So it's doing the research first. Like January said, there's a great obligation to the people who love, know and love these shows, that when you do these books that you say, I know it means a lot that if I'm doing a character that sounds one way on the TV show and I don't sound like that in the book, people are going to go, I don't even know now. I'm out of it. I can't understand what's happening here. It's a great example. If you were going to do Mr. Scott from the original series and just ignore the Scottish accent, people are going to be like, wait, what are you doing? So you know, you just have to know, you know, and it took me a while, like characters like Sulu, you know, George Takei is a little back here. And so once I tapped into that, I was able to do Sulu. And it, no one's going to go, oh my God, that's George Takei. But it does, it, people go, oh, that's Sulu. I hear it now. The original series made it very easy because everyone had their own accent. The one I struggle the most with is Uhura, because it's not distinctive enough for what I can do. I'll bet you do a great Uhura. but I she's the one that every time I'm like, oh, I'm listening to clips right before I do her again. I'm like, no, I've never conquered her. But yeah, so I will listen to the series. I'll prepare the clips. Yeah. And then again, like January, once there's a brand new character, then you start going, okay, what is the author? What has John told me about this character? What do we do? And John, yeah, God love him, you know, like on The High Country, you know, he sends some notes. Hey, this character, I'm thinking sort of like this. This character, yeah, in The High Country, he's mentioned that one character could sound sort of like a Max von Sydow, you know, and a flavor of that. I'm like, oh, thank you. You know, I'm always looking for the character that I can do my James Mason imitation of, because I love to come in and do James Mason. So if there is a moment where I can find a place to put a character like that, I'll do it. It's just a fun thing.
Making a note here like for January, my next book here, James Mason.
That's right. But it's like January mentioned, we have voices, we have certain sounds we know we can make. And so you look at a character and you're like, oh, there's a great place for that. And of course, I'm not going to do the exact same thing rhythmically or whatever, but I've got that. I've got a voice for that character. And then it comes the big component for me with all of my Star Trek books, which is then I start talking to Karen Perlman,
who is
the producer, director. And Karen is, I mean, there's no Star Trek. There's no Robert Peckoff doing Star Trek without Karen Perlman, because she does so much research. She looks up all the Klingon, you know, she gets the pronunciation and, you know, I'll hear it in my head. No. And then we'll go back and do the thing again. No, it's more like, no, more like this. And so she's just a phenomenal asset to the Star Trek universe.
She is.
Every audiobook starts with Karen on Star Trek contacting me, and we go over the list of, you know, characters that I've created from scratch, and then there's a handful that are just extremely, you know, obscure that I'm like, okay, no, this person is actually episode this has one line or something like that. But yeah, I do try to give information about how the characters could sound, because one of the things I do, I don't have omniscient narrators. All of my books are told through point of view characters, so they're always acting. They're always in somebody's voice, and often it's somebody's voice that we haven't met before. You know, in some cases, you know, there are characters that one of the things that I love hearing is you guys do such wonderful work on the characters that we've met. And then there are the characters that we've only met like once or twice. The character Kivas Fejo, who was in Rogue Elements, comes from one episode of The Next Generation, played by Saul Rubinek, who people probably most remember from being Daphne's boyfriend on Frasier. And, you know, Robert just kills all the segments that he's in. And then again, January, you know, there's a stretch in Die Standing where you've got to do significant work with Finnegan. And Finnegan is this, you know, leprechaunish, you know, cartoon nightmare from James Kirk's cadet past. You know, we actually put some deep thought into what he would sound like. I love listening to the work you guys have done with these characters.
We're talking with John Jackson Miller, January Lavoy, and Robert Petkoff here on Wisconsin Public Radio's Route 51. January, tell us about the actual recording process. How many takes does it need on average? How many voices in a session? I'd like actually January to start, and Robert, would you continue after that?
Yeah, I do it all in one take, and I don't make any mistakes, so it's really efficient.
She's amazing. She's amazing.
No, that's not true. I'm being facetious, but I am pretty efficient. But, you know, you really don't think about, when you're doing commercial work, you think about it as takes, right? Mm-hmm. Let's try it again and do it this way. Let's try it again a little more like this. We do not have the luxury when we have, you know, a 12 or 15 or 18 hour audiobook to be able to do multiple takes. So again, you have to talk about the preparation so much because you rely on the preparation when you get in the booth and you have to just deliver as many finished hours of the book per day as you can. So I average about an hour of a book. It takes me about an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes. But that's still, you know, we're talking about making just misreads. You know, you make a mistake, and our job is to represent every single sound and syllable on the page. We do not get to go close enough. No. If the word is tasks, and I say task, and it's not clear that I mean tasks, then Karen Perlman, who I also need to endorse and just say she's amazing. I finished my last book of 2022 with her this afternoon remotely in the studio. She's incredible. But, you know, Karen's like, no, sorry, I didn't hear the S on the end of tasks. And you got to go back to the last breath, wherever that was, and pick up right where you were. So at times, especially when you are doing, you know, tricky space names or, oh, you know, scientific terminology, it can be a real mouthful. And so one of the things that you sometimes have to do is, if you keep tripping over the same thing, which can happen, if there's something there that's just not intuitive for you, I have to stop and say, okay, I need to write a phonetic version of this in my script right now, or I will not be able to get past this point. So things like that in the process are, you know, you work it out in the moment, but ultimately the performance really comes out in real time. You're trying to be as close to one take as you possibly can be from start to finish, which makes it exciting too.
Robert.
It is. I mean, it's storytelling. And we, generally speaking, if we're sitting around a campfire and we're telling a story, we aren't going to start an entire paragraph and then go, you know what? I don't like the way I did that for you guys. Let me do it again. You're just going to do it. Now, it has happened for me where I've started a character and gotten about a page in and said, you know what? I'm just now starting to get the right feel for it. I'm going to start this whole page again.
Yes.
And do that. And it's not that often, but every once in a while you're like, ooh, I'm in the zone now for that. But for the most part, you're just going to read that book out loud and try to read it at a pace that is both exciting to listen to and at a pace that is also not going to make you make a ton of mistakes. You can't read too fast because people can't listen to it, the whole thing. But you don't want to do it so slow that, yeah, I'm not going to make any mistakes, but now no one's going to be listening. They're going to tune out. And so I always try to think of myself as trying to tell the story to someone and to entertain someone. That helps me as a sort of an exercise, is keep it alive and keep it in the air and keep it moving. But again, you know, the minute you make a mistake, the minute you do something wrong, you've got that. Karen is right there to say, no, I didn't understand that. Let's do it. And occasionally Karen will just say, I didn't get the point of what you were trying to make. Mm-hmm. You know, And I'm like, oh, okay, well, then we have to do that again. Or she'll say, I think if you stress this word, that makes it clearer. And I'm like, no, he's trying to say this. And she go, yes, but do you hear that? And I'm like, oh, yep, I sure do. There it is.
Yeah.
You know, or I say, no, I don't hear that. And you're wrong. But, but we'll go back and forth from sometimes, but it's a sense of trying to keep telling that story and tell it in as efficient a way as possible. Because again, you only have so many days to get this done. And there have been times where I've gone through half the book and gone, I hate what I have done with this character. I've made a huge mistake, but I've painted myself into a corner and I have no choice but to go on. And now I'm going to modulate it just slightly every chapter from here on out until I get it to where I want it. And so the listener doesn't go, wait, that person was completely different at the beginning of the book. It just, you get subtle and you have to make it work, but you don't get the chance to go back and do it all again.
John, both January and Robert talked about honoring the properties of Star Trek, Star Wars. You're creating new characters from time to time. Yeah. When you think of the characters, think of the dialogue. Is this something that you're actually perhaps had a dream about, or in some sort of state these things came to your mind?
Well,
what's that process?
I always have sort of an audio, you know, I'm hearing the characters talk in my own head. So I have my, you know, notion of what they should sound like. You know, Robert mentioned the Max von Sydow sort of character. I do that anyway, just to sort of get that character's voice in my head, because I don't have TV as the crutch to help me along. I don't have the movie to help me along. You know, often what will happen is once one of my characters has been recorded, I'll use that from now on. So, for example, one of the Star Wars stories that January recorded of mine is in the From a Certain Point of View Empire Strikes Back book. You know, she does a reading of Rae Sloane, who is a character that I've done in the New Dawn novel and a bunch of other short stories as well. And they just made a Lego out of her. That's really cool. but, you know, that's something where, you know, I'm aware now of her intonations, how she's doing the character. And I'm probably going to use that or incorporate it in the future, because it's now the official Rae Sloane, at least until another official one comes along somewhere. Because, again, all these characters are played by multiple people, even Captain Kirk and Spock and everybody else. I will say, you know, January had mentioned, you know, the space names thing. One of the things that's happened since I've become conscious that, you know, these books are going to be read aloud is it's changed the way I write. I'm no longer doing space names. I'm no longer doing incredibly long names that are very difficult to say.
And thank you, John.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you, John.
I realize you know, it's either going to be you or Mark Thompson or Scott Brick or Luke Daniels or somebody else who's read my books or Robert. Somebody's going to curse me if I put a $10, $12, you know, word or a very, very long name. You know, I've always said, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, they don't need help seeming otherworldly. So we don't need extremely crazy names that are difficult to pronounce, apart from the whole Klingon thing, which is another thing entirely. That's part of the flavor. But yeah, I mean, that's one way I've changed. Another way I have changed is my chapters are short. The novel that Robert's in studio with the Strange New Worlds novel, The High Country, it's 79 chapters. And it's in part because we know a lot more about how people read books from Amazon and their tracking. We know the same thing about how people listen to books and how long they listen to them. And people are listening to these things on commutes. The satisfying chunk of a story has more tended to be something like what's in between commercial breaks on TV. I try not to give any chapter more than what would be about a 6-minute segment, you know, when it's actually, you know, spoken aloud. And it works out, you know, book-wise to about 1,300 words. And again, it helps my stories, I think, because it allows a lot more cliffhangers and a lot more what we call density of incident. A lot of stuff happens in my books, or at least I try to make it happen. So so again, I am in solidarity with the people who are both reading it you know, on the page and then reading it aloud.
For narrators as well in the studio, the short chapters help us because we can take a break if we're going to work to the end of this chapter and then, you know, use the restroom or order lunch or do whatever. And when I look at some of the David Foster Wallace novels I've done, you're sometimes like, David, you're never going to let me have lunch because the chapter is so long and it goes on forever. So it's really wonderful for the narrator as well to have these shorter chapters.
Robert Petkoff, January Lavoie, and John Jackson Miller are our guests today on Route 51. Ahead, we'll talk a little bit more about creating audiobooks and what's coming up for this trio of page turners. I'm Rick Ryer, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're dealing with the convincers, pal.
The convincers? Another new one on Rios. Sounds like a debate club.
Ledger looked to the gun-toting guards now flanking her. Show them what a convincer is. At her command, they sprayed the ceiling with automatic projectile fire. Some club, she shouted over the din. Whatever response she'd expected from Rios, he didn't give it to her. Instead, he just stared at the ceiling, which was now raining dust from multiple holes.
What was the point of that?
It makes an impression, Burrs shouted.
Certainly with your upstairs neighbors.
We don't have any.
Not anymore.
Thank you for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer. January Lavoie, Robert Petkoff, and John Jackson Miller are our guests today as we continue our conversation about audiobook production and what's ahead in 2023 for our guests. And we just heard an audio excerpt courtesy of Simon & Schuster from Star Trek Picard, Rogue Elements by John, and read by Robert Petkoff. Keeping those voices together in your head, it's incredible.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun. Actually, Rios is my new favorite character.
Robert.
I want Rios to have his own series.
Me too. And I wonder if you had the same reaction I did when you were watching the series, because I did a Picard book too. And I was like, wait, how many voices does he have?
You get to do all those characters? The actor is tremendous in it. And
he's
incredible. Like, that's the character. That's the role I would want to play.
Yes. Santiago Cabrera does five versions of himself in addition to himself. And so this is the trick in doing the voices is, you know, it's not that, it's not that you're doing an Irish accent or a Scottish accent or anything like that. You're doing Rios's version of a Scottish accent or an Irish accent. And so, you know, when I'm sending notes, I said, Mr. Hospitality is just like a game show host on amphetamines. I mean, it's just, it's just wonderful to be able to have these characters play off of each other. If the readers weren't able to sell that, if the people performing it weren't able to sell that these were different people, January in the Die Standing book does two different versions of Michelle Yeoh's character, Philippa Georgiou. And I put them in conversation with each other at one point. And if you hadn't already gone through the whole book, understanding that these are different voices, different points of view, they evoke different feelings when they talk, they're coming from a different place. She's established that. By that point in the book, we've both earned that moment for them to see each other, but we've also, definitely set it up so people are going to know what's going on when they're listening. They're going to know who's talking. And that requires specific talent that you guys have.
Thank you, John.
January, you had an encounter with a fan who said audiobooks helped her sons develop a love of reading. What challenges do audiobooks, from your perspective, help people overcome?
Oh, there are so many. That's not the only person who's said that to me about kids having access. And that was in particular a mom, I believe that was at Star Wars Celebration. And she was talking about both of her sons who were there with her at the time. I think they were in their late teens, but they had both experienced, challenges, learning challenges. And one she mentioned was dyslexic and really feared books, just didn't want to be near books. And you know, he got into Star Wars, and then she was like, well, there's these audio versions of these books you love, and it changed his life. I'm like getting goosebumps talking about it because I remember how grateful she was for the existence of these books. I know that there's also been a lot of use of audiobooks in prisons because the literacy rate in prisons is often extremely low. And many folks who are working toward degrees and higher education while incarcerated use audiobooks in order to be able to raise up their literacy. I mean, the fact that we're finally coming to a place where people are acknowledging that humans learn differently, and none of those modalities of learning are better or worse than others. I feel very proud to be part of an industry that I think has really helped to expose that truth to people. And there's still a few people who like to, you know, every once in a while, somebody wants to write an article that says that audiobooks aren't really reading, you know, and it's like, I don't know that there's really any need to debate that when the outcomes are clear, that you can have two people, one person who has read the paper version of a book and one person who has listened to the audiobook. Those two people can talk about every detail of the book. They can have a conversation. The experience they had at the end of it is the same. And many people, fans of audiobooks, would argue that the person who listened had the enhanced experience. Some people love having that interlocutor in between. Some people don't, and that's fine. I personally love to listen. When I listen to audiobooks, I mostly listen to author reads, funnily enough, because I like hearing, you know, nonfiction in author voices. What's wonderful about it is it's just another way for people to access more storytelling and more information. And that on balance is always good for people. That's my personal belief.
Well, it says a lot about the power of the human voice.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. There's a connection. And of course, you know, the thing breathing down all of our necks is this question about AI. Right. And, you know, if you want to strike fear in the heart of a professional narrator, bring up this idea of AI. And it's funny, we're sitting here talking about, you know, Star Trek and Star Wars. And I just think, look, there's a place for technology, but we're not listening to and watching and consuming Star Trek and Star Wars because the machines are so smart that they've made people irrelevant. The human experience is at the heart of all of these properties. And I'm old enough to remember when CGI started and green screens and everyone was like, there's not going to be any more actors. It's all going to be computers. And then they made that Polar Express movie and people were like, that made me feel weird. And then they found a way to make CGI and acting supportive of each other. And I feel very strongly, I'm very committed to the idea that people listen to audiobooks, not just because it's an efficient way of consuming the material, but because in the same way that they feel connected to their favorite authors and their favorite stories, I think people feel very connected to their favorite narrators and the different kinds of experiences that they can have listening to books that are narrated by other human beings.
Absolutely. AI is very efficient at telling me what the words on the page are. Mm-hmm. But so far, AI is not as good at telling me what the words on the page are with emotion and with feeling, or AI can't make me feel something. Now, I'm sure it will get very good at inflection and all of that. But the interpretation of an artist, as opposed to the interpretation of a computer that's been trained to pretend to be an artist, is still, I think, a long way off. I pray. You know,
we hope.
When green screens were coming up, I kept thinking, well, listen, they may replace physical actors, but the voice, they're always going to need the voice. And now they're going, eh, maybe we don't need that. But I do believe that we are able to tell a story right now much better than a computer can.
And I agree. Just real quick, the books that I've written that I think have been most successful in terms of, well, both, you know, critically, but also in terms of me achieving what I wanted to achieve, would have been the Kenobi novel, the Die Standing, and Rogue Elements. All three are books about people that are in pain. They have had a loss. They've had a major loss in their lives. Obi-Wan Kenobi's lost the Jedi and the Republic and all of his friends. Emperor Jojo's lost a universe. And Rios has lost Starfleet and direction. And, you know, we're in their voices for most of these books. But again, you know, you've got to be able to, you know, sell that. And by the time we've been with the narrator, by the time we've been with the speaker, by the time we've been with these characters, We've got to have that feeling there. And if it were just, you know, being, you know, narrated by AI, if Alexa were telling it to me, I would not get the same feeling as I would get after I've heard it from Robert or January after 10 hours. You know, okay, we're now to the dramatic, you know, core of what this character is going through. I mean, it's a performance.
We have about 4 minutes left in the program. January, what's next for you?
Oh, I've been working on some really cool books. Can I plug a book that is not not a John book?
Yes, you can.
Is that okay?
I don't have time to write them all.
I just did this book and like calling all my nerds, because my space nerds, and you know, for anybody who shed a tear when Mars Insight said goodbye to us this week, like I did. I did this book. I just finished recording this book that's going to be out in January. It's called The New Guys by Meredith Bagby, and it is the history of the shuttle program. And it starts with the class of 1977, which was the first integrated class of astronauts. And it takes us all the way through to the end, the completion of the International Space Station and the end of the shuttle program. And I loved this book so much. I was challenged by this book. The way that government and history and science and personality all come together and put us in space. And I couldn't do this show about these books without saying, you know, if you're into the nonfiction thing, it's just a fabulous, fabulous read, a fabulous listen. So that'll be out in a few weeks, and I highly recommend it.
Robert, what's next for you?
Well, next week I go back in the studio to record a young, up-and-coming author named John Jackson Miller, and his new book, Star Trek: The High Country. It's a Strange New Worlds book, and it's so far so good. I've done 2 days of it so far, and it's a lot of fun. You know, I love the new crew, Christopher Pike and all of them, and Spock and Una and all those people. And then in January, late January, I'll head out to Chicago to do some Shakespeare, back to my roots. I'm going to do the Comedy of Errors at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater.
Oh, fun.
So that should be a lot of fun.
And John?
Okay, running down the list real quick. With Dark Horse Comics, I have a comic series called Skull and Bones, which I wrote with my buddy James Mishler, based on the new Ubisoft video game that's coming out. Marvel is re-releasing my Knight Errant comics in March. I have two books coming where I'm a part of them from Vernon Press, which are books about the history of Star Wars and Star Trek fiction. And then there's Strange New Worlds, which comes out in audiobook, ebook, and hardcover on February 21st from Gallery Books. Again, this is just a wonderful, fun book. It is, we have Captain Pike on a horse. What more do we need? It's been described not just as a Western. It's really more of a science fiction novel with horses. So I had a ball writing it, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Robert does with it.
Well, we're running low on dilithium on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, once again thanking our guests, John Jackson Miller, January Lavoie, and Robert Petkoff. Our producers today are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Ezra Wall. And a special nod to David Bowie, the Steve Miller Band, Styx, the Alan Parsons Project, and Simon & Schuster for the audio excerpts. You can hear the archive of Route 51 at wpr.org/route51 or on your favorite podcast platform. Join us next week for a look at space from a science fact perspective with two local astronomers. Until then, we're heading in for a landing.